Come into the circle of love and justice. Come into the community of mercy, holiness, and health. Come and you shall know peace and joy. I have a prayer here written by Judith Hill on September 12, 2001. Wage peace with your breath. Breathe in firemen and rubble. Breathe out wholeness and flocks of red-winged blackbirds. Breathe in terrorists. Breathe out sleeping children and freshly mown fields. Breathe in confusion. Breathe out maple trees. Breathe in the fallen. Breathe out lifelong friendships intact. Wage peace with your listening. Hear sirens. Pray. Remember your tools. Flower seeds, clothespins, rivers. Make soup. Play music. Memorize the words for thank you in three languages. Learn to knit. Make a hat. Think of chaos as dancing raspberries. Imagine grief as the outbreath of beauty or the gesture of fish. Swim for the other side. Wage peace. Never has the world seemed so fresh and precious. Have a cup of tea and rejoice. Act as if armistice has already arrived. Celebrate today. Well, thanks for having me back. This is the room where I became a Unitarian Universalist, and so it always feels a little like home. It's great to be back. It's great to experience the wonderful music that's here in Janet's hymn and in the great music by 1001 Nights, too. In the reading that David led for us, we were reminded of the numerous injunctions in the Judeo-Christian tradition which encourage us to peace. Now, the religious tradition which has meant the most to me recently is the inspiring text, the Tao Te Ching, the 2,000-year-old Chinese text. And I read from a recent translation by Stephen Mitchell. There is no greater illusion than fear, no greater wrong than preparing to defend yourself. No greater misfortune than having an enemy. Whoever can see through all fear will always be safe. For every force, there is counterforce. Violence, even well-intentioned violence, will always rebound on itself. Weapons are the tools of violence, the tools of fear, and a decent person will avoid them, except in the most direst necessity, and use them only with the utmost restraint. One's enemies are not demons, but human beings like oneself. Do not rejoice in victory, for every victory is a funeral for kin. Give evil nothing to oppose, and it will disappear of itself. There can be no wholeness in war. Only in peace is there wholeness. Now, these are only a few of the countless passages that we could find in all of the world's spiritual texts that warn against building a civilization, a culture driven by militarism. Only some of the many that would encourage us in general to peace and patience, compassion, and understanding. A year and a half ago, the world's clergy stood almost completely united in their opposition to a unilateral action in Iraq. In Austin, all three UU ministers, Reverend Lohr, Chuck Freeman, and Kathleen Ellis, all delivered very strong statements from the pulpit. They were joined not only by individuals, but organizations of Catholics, Presbyterians, Muslims, of course, even George Bush's Methodists. However, many UUs, I recognize, are somewhat suspicious of religious texts and even somewhat suspicious of religious leaders. So I offer you an alternative authority this morning. 50 years ago, in a world recovering from the greatest war it had ever known, a struggle against a fascist militaristic nation bent on world domination, and reeling from our use of the most horrible weaponry that man had ever devised, many of the world's leaders spoke out about what they saw as an emerging problem, the increasing power and influence of the sponsors of the American military. In his last writings, incomplete and found on his desk, Albert Einstein, thought by many to be among the most brilliant minds in a century, in fact, Time magazine's Man of the Century, wrote the following words. I quote, "The conflict that exists today is no more than an old-style struggle for power, once again presented to mankind in semi-religious trappings. The difference is that this time, the development of atomic power has imbued the struggle with a ghostly character, for both parties know and admit that should the quarrel deteriorate into actual war, mankind is doomed. Despite this knowledge, statesmen in responsible positions on both sides continue to employ the well-known technique of seeking to intimidate and demoralize the opponent by marshaling superior military strength. They do so even though such a policy entails the risk of war and doom. Not one statesman in a position of responsibility has dared to pursue the only course that holds out any promise of peace, the course of supranational security, since for a statesman to follow such a course would be tantamount to political suicide. Political passions, once they have been fanned into flame, exact their victims." End quote. Now, Albert Schweitzer gave up his career as a theologian to go back to school, learn medicine, and then practice healing among the most poor people in the world in Africa. With his lucent words and his life of service, many know him as perhaps the greatest philanthropist of the last century. I'm quote from his writings now. "In becoming supermen, we have become monsters. We have permitted masses of people in wartime to be destroyed, whole cities with their inhabitants to be wiped out, and human beings to be turned into blazing torches by flamethrowers. We learn of these happenings through the radio and newspaper, and we judge them according to whether they bring success to the group of nations to which we belong or to our enemies. When we admit such things are an act of inhumanity, we do so with a reservation that we are forced by the facts of war to let them happen. When without further effort we resign ourselves to this fate, we become ourselves guilty of barbarity. Today it is essential that we should all of us admit this inhumanity. That frightful experience that we have shared should arouse us to do everything possible, in the hope that we can bring to pass an age when war shall be no more. This determination and this hope can only lead in one direction, that we should attain by new spirit that higher reasonableness that would prevent the unholy use of the might that is now in our command." End quote. Now, Martin Luther King Jr. was as much a power for peace as he was for justice, and even as the civil rights movement that he led began to transform our nation, King was turning his ministry to what he saw as a growing emphasis on another kind of state-sponsored violence. I quote, "A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. Our scientific power has outrun our spiritual power. We have guided missiles and misguided men." End quote. But perhaps a most surprising voice spoke out as well. In 1953, Dwight David Eisenhower was president of the United States. The most powerful man in the world, and perhaps the most famous soldier of his century. He was respected in every corner of the globe, and yet still worried about a growing power which he could not counter. I quote, "Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one heavy modern bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is two electric power plants, each serving 60,000. It is two fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete highway. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed 8,000 people. This, I repeat, is the best way of life to be found on the road that the world has been taking. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under a cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging on a cross of iron. End quote. Where are our leaders today on this issue? Why is this voice stilled? The only voices who even approach this issue now are from the entertainment world. Our leaders have been almost silent since those days of Mohandas Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr., John Lennon, Bobby Kennedy, Anwar Sadat. But perhaps I answer my own question. In considering current affairs, perhaps it would be constructive to take an historical view of fairly recent United States military engagements, and we'll start with World War II. Now, in the Good War, the United States was the sleeping giant. Like the Gary Cooper and Jimmy Stewart screen heroes of the day, the country was very slow to anger, but terrible in its wrath when it could take no more. The U.S. stood by while Germany and Japan attacked ally after ally in strong and silent restraint until it could be restrained no longer. When America did enter the war, the country was unified in its resolve and unqualified in its success. With a good bit of help from some friends, of course, America vanquished Hitler and took over 100,000 Japanese lives in 2 days to defeat Hirohito. The result was that our country, while taking fewer casualties in Europe than Canada in World War II, was given the respect and appreciation of the world for these victories. And the resulting national self-satisfaction and glory was just enough to serve as a salve for those deep wounds that war, even popular and successful war, always causes. But since World War II, the United States has been intoxicated with the success and power. With the much more ready fists and trigger fingers like the screen heroes portrayed by Charles Bronson, Clint Eastwood, and Chuck Norris, we've been ready to enter fights all around the globe. With George Bush the Elder's coalition forces, America endured only 125 casualties in Desert Storm, many from friendly fire, while destroying over 3,800 tanks, 1,400 armored personnel carriers, and 141 airplanes, and taking 60,000 prisoners and an unknown number of thousands of Iraqi lives in only a few days. Do not think, though, in this election year that I am making a partisan speech on a partisan issue. In 1997, dozens of countries from around the world signed a landmine ban treaty. This treaty, proposed by an American homemaker and endorsed by the UN, Princess Diana, and the Pope, outlaws the use of anti-personnel mines due to the horrible effects they have for generations on civilian post-war civilian populations. The United States, led by then-President Bill Clinton, would not sign this treaty because we are using landmines extensively in our ongoing border Cold War in Korea. The following year, another international effort, this one endorsed by former President Carter, circulated another treaty outlawing the use of miners in combat. The signing countries agreed to end practices which have seen 10- and 12-year-olds toting automatic weapons and young girls of 8 used to detect landmines. The United States, because we actively recruit 17-year-olds for our military, would not sign this treaty either. President Clinton's refusal to sign either treaty describes our arrogance. We simply will not make any concession for peace. And now our history, of course, arrives at September 11, 2001. I do not wish to diminish those heinous acts, but before that awful day, terrorism in the United States was largely about white supremacists and animal rights groups. And since September 11th, we've hardly seen a rash of ongoing terrorist attacks. Al-Qaeda was a known threat by our intelligence organizations before September 11th, and it, of course, remains a very prominent threat now. But instead of declaring Al-Qaeda public enemy number one and employing the world's cooperation and sympathy exclusively to track down these criminals and prevent them from doing further harm, President Bush declared war on terror. If abstract terror, or even generalized terrorism, is our opponent, This is a war which we can engage in as long as we want to. Because the enemy is of our own invention, and we cannot be defeated. Truly, in the words of John Lennon, war is over, if you want it. And America entered into a war in Iraq. We have lost over 600 American lives and perhaps 15 times that number of Iraqi lives in this conflict, and it does not seem near to any sort of end. We were told that we entered this war because of the threat of weapons of mass destruction. We've not only not found any evidence of these weapons, but we remain the only world organization which has used weapons of mass destruction, and we have discarded our efforts to control our own exercise of them, and we've set about building more. We were told we entered this war because of Hussein's atrocities. However, Hussein operated one of the more liberal totalitarian Arab countries, more liberal, for example, than our friends the Saudis and the Kuwaitis, whose sovereignty we fought to protect, and we have turned our head from genocide in Africa and from genocide in Southeast Asia. We were told we entered this war to liberate the Iraqis and give them freedom and democracy. We were told this as our Marines went to Haiti to help depose the elected leader there and deny those people their vote. It is apparent we entered this war for reasons that our leadership does not want made clear. But I can tell you, these reasons are mostly about money and they're about power. Ironically, the United States' leading religion is Christianity, and it's our deepest cultural heritage. Even employing the most pedestrian of translations in the Gospels, Jesus speaks three times more often of peace than he does of salvation. And yet this message from the Prince of Peace is lost across the millennia on our country and on our leaders. President Bush, not Mother Teresa or the Pope, has arguably become the most visible figure in Christendom. He speaks often of his devotion. But it may be difficult to find a recent American leader who has so consistently made decisions which resulted in the deaths of others, going back to when he was governor of Texas and turned Texas into the death penalty capital of the world. It is easy to see how those of other cultures perceive this as a holy war on both sides when someone who wants to be seen as such a religious leader is also such a military leader. However, one finds little of a devout mentality in our use of shock and awe tactics against civilian populations, and the bounties placed on Iraqi leaders. The president's labeling the leaders of other nations as an axis of evil, his military incursions in multiple spheres, his fear-mongering in the United States have generally served to increase the level of violence in the world. Will President Bush actually buy any measure of peace in the Middle East with any of these deaths, as President Carter did with peaceful diplomacy at Camp David? Is the world more peaceful or more safe now? Christians and other Americans who have recently seen Mel Gibson's film, The Passion of the Christ, might ask themselves, does their nation more closely resemble a kingdom of God with justice, forgiveness, and compassion as described by Jesus, one who would turn the other cheek and forgive those who know not what they do? Or does it more resemble the Roman Empire, projecting itself through puppet governments, torture, occupying armies, and economic power all over the known world? 5 days a week we work, tithing most of us 8 to 10% of our wages to our martial cause. On Sundays, we come here, we drop a few coins in the plate, and we occasionally talk and sing about peace. Now, as a frequent business traveler overseas, the reason why Arabs and others, including Jamaicans and Canadians, resent us is because of our interventions. With our World Bank, CIA, and active military, our meddling sows the fear and hatred that we reap, and our gluttonous consumption of resources and opulent wealth is the fertilizer. In the last several years, I've had the privilege to travel all around in the world, and in my travels, particularly in Saudi Arabia, I found people open to discussing their image of our country and the relationship that we have with them. I believe you would find the foreign press, though, will reinforce my anecdotal reports that around the world, the United States is perceived as a militaristic people. a militaristic people who can be counted on to flex our muscle. But often for peace, but sometimes seemingly just to flex our muscle. But how can this be? Americans are the most diverse, generous, and freedom-loving people on the planet. For every country that we number among our enemies, we have a substantial number of their descendants living productively and happily among us. If we can be so closely allied with an ally, an absolute monarchy which permits no rights for women and no freedom of religion, there is no reason why we should not be able to find common ground with any nation on earth. Instead, our leadership seems to find new threats and new enemies for us daily. This year, we will spend almost $500 billion on our military. Around $100 billion of this is on the war in Iraq. Over $10 billion on strategic ballistic missiles. We will spend hundreds of billions more on the interest on prior military spending and the deficit. All of this spending is about half of our federal budget. By contrast, we will spend about $40 billion, less than 10% of the pre-war military spending, on food stamps and welfare assistance programs. We will spend a recently cut $15 billion on NASA, and we will spend $135 million on renewable energy research. Let me repeat that. $500 billion on military, $135 million on renewable energy research. Our military budget is not just more than the combined military budgets of pre-war Iraq, Afghanistan, North Korea, and Cuba. We're talking about four very poor countries here. It is more than the combined gross national product of these countries. Even more amazing, our military budget is 40% of all military spending worldwide, and it's significantly larger than the next 10 largest military budgets in the world combined. Do any of these next 10 military budgets represent our enemies? Even China, in that number, has most favored nation status. Our pseudo-governmental economic powers also spend tens of billions on World Bank loans that manipulate foreign governments by gaining economic control over them. And our CIA is involved not just in research, but active manipulation of governments in many regions. Manipulations which may have included assassination and coup. Manipulations which on several occasions have trained and armed those who would later threaten us. And even if they don't threaten us, we support people who provide instability in many regions of the world. Frankly, we are bullies who force others to accept our version of what's good for them or what's good for us and enforce this with our might and our money. In the half century since World War II, we have built the greatest warrior nation the world has ever known. We here in this room are responsible for this, the greatest warrior nation the world has ever known. We are responsible to the extent we have a democracy. And to the extent we deny responsibility, we are responsible for our lost democracy. And we're also responsible for the pain that our lost democracy causes on the rest of the inhabitants of our planet. Who are our enemies? What do we fear? After the Cold War, the greatest threat to America is perhaps terrorism. I would agree with that. And our stealth bombers and aircraft carriers don't protect us from this at all. In fact, our image as the great bully makes us more vulnerable to terrorists. In a sense, with our inappropriate level of military power and aggressive foreign policy, for small countries and political organizations, we are terrorists. And terrorism seems to them the appropriate response. Al-Qaeda is not recent and is not a bin Laden personality cult. This is a long-standing organization, and part of their goals involve new government in Saudi Arabia. This regime change is not one that our government sees in our best interest, and so we continue to support the Saudi monarchy. These revolutionaries, who I completely acknowledge have committed loathsome acts of international terrorism, have no self-determination at the ballot box, and they have no self-determination in the ballot box in part because we have abandoned our ideals in their region. Now more than ever, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear which has become our national policy. A national policy that's holding back and holding down our economy. Could the answers to our fears be simpler? Could it be as simple as pointing to the thing that we fear the most, shouting, "Ridiculous!" and then laughing a little bit? Well, maybe Michael Moore seems to think so. Here, have some chocolate. It really helps. You want my chocolate? I can't give away chocolate today. Instead of reassurance to other countries, we exhibit arrogance and hypocrisy. Our elections are far from perfect. Moneyed interests have too much influence. Our current president did not get a popular majority. We have serious social problems, which indicate that in our quest for freedom, we may have lost some of our spiritual and moral center. Our economic center, our system has recently served to widen the gap between rich and poor. Even so, we are gluttons, often just for pleasure, and we seem to flaunt these blessings in the face of those with less, much less. It doesn't make it easier for them when we whine about hard times when others have it so much harder. Smaller countries like Canada and Sweden have better health care. Poorer countries like Jamaica and even our enemy Cuba have higher literacy rates by some reports. I'm not sure that's true. We have people starving in the world's breadbasket, even though they are obese, because they're eating empty calories. Our once legendary edge in technical knowledge and Yankee ingenuity is apparently waning as companies outsource software and engineering to India and Russia. We've not only rejected international peace and disarmament treaties, we have withdrawn from the Kyoto Environmental Accords in process and other international cooperative efforts as well. Our environment, which was improving for decades until recently, is now back in decline. What kind of example do we set for other countries? Is this any kind of world leadership that we can be proud of? What about patriotism? Has my apparent cynicism about our world role destroyed my loyalty to America? No. I hold in high regard the ideals of this nation, the ideals of people who were established holding that all people are created equal, who had the ideals of people who crossed oceans and climbed mountains to settle uncharted territories, who believed in self-determination and who continue to believe in representative government and economic freedom, who believe in community and were ruled by town meetings and people who helped their neighbors. I believe in the nation that gave birth to Henry Thoreau, Jack Kerouac, jazz, and rock and roll. I believe in the people who have the ingenuity and the dedication to walk on the moon. A people who have fought and died and sacrificed money and advantage for freedom. Freedom which has brought us cultural wealth and, yes, economic wealth beyond our wildest dreams. A people who have become the most diverse and free culture in the history of our planet. A celebration of human life. But we have become a people that do not dream big and go boldly where no one goes has gone before. Rather, we are becoming a people who fear the unraveling that we see tearing at other parts of the world. We worry that frequent terrorism, more rampant disease, more harsh poverty and shortages will come here and threaten our families, our way of life, our stuff. We're called by our government not to bravely endeavor together to solve these problems and the problems of the world, but we are called by our government to fear. Have we become a people that rather than strive to rise ourselves and lead others, have set ourselves to holding others down so that we can remain on top? Can we do this and remain the land of the free and the home of the brave? Rather than fearing the unraveling by batting at everything that might be pulling on a thread, Americans should start knitting. Across a small bit of the Hudson Bay from the gaping hole in New York City, which is a reminder of that horrifying day, stands the Statue of Liberty. In the 19th century, the statue was a gift to the United States from France, recognizing our world leadership. Not world leadership, not military leadership in time of war, But a leadership of ideas authored in part, large part, by our Unitarian predecessors, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Ralph Waldo Emerson, among many others. Leadership which inspired others to struggle for cultural, religious, political freedom. Today, our world leadership includes violent movies, violent music, economic manipulation and intrigue, unethical corporations, weapon systems, standing armies, and fear. What kind of monument will other countries build for us today? Former President and recent Nobel Prize winner Jimmy Carter reminds us, it is important for us to remember that the United States did not invent human rights. Rather, human rights invented the United States. Perhaps it is time for us to return to and struggle to deserve this heritage. President George H. Bush the Elder has called the challenge presented by the conspiracy of globally organized terror the greatest challenge any American president has faced since Lincoln. Now, that other Republican president, almost a century and a half ago, wrote something that haunts me when I read it. I quote, "I see in the near future a crisis approaching that unnerves me and causes me to tremble for the safety of my country. As a result of the war, financial interests have been enthroned, and an era of corruption in high places will follow, and the money power of the country will endeavor to prolong its reign by working upon the prejudices of the people until all wealth is aggregated in a few hands and the republic is destroyed." End quote. If you, like me, are willing to call private control of the American government and private control of the American military a conspiracy of globally organized terror, then I think we can agree with both Presidents Bush and President Lincoln. I propose to face such a challenge. We will need true patriotism, the kind of patriotism that springs from a people whose government truly represents the diverse and moral people that they are, the patriotism of a people proud of our communal life and our relations with others. It is important that we reclaim a foreign policy not driven by self-interest or national interest, but a foreign policy that represents the highest values and cultural diversity of our great people. After World War II, around the time of my birth, our society undertook the great struggle of the modern civil rights movement. Though incomplete, great progress has been made over the last half century. This effort has been 50 years in developing. It may take another 50 years, but it is a struggle for our nation's soul, and we are winning it. And this great struggle began right here in the pulpits of Unitarian and Universalist and other churches. And it began right here in the hearts and the consciences of our people. Now I call us to a new struggle, one that is no less for our collective salvation and no lesser a task. This will not be easy. We will first have to reclaim our democracy from those with both the power of money and the power of lethal force and the proven willingness to use both. Like the struggle for civil rights, neither party in our political system will face this issue unless forced. Those who run our country have proven that their loyalties are first to these financial interests and then some to the rest of us somewhat later. John Kerry and the Democrats in convention were intentionally jingoistic, marching to a martial tune. To do this, we must be patriotic in the traditional sense. We must be willing to assert our democratic right, nay, our responsibility of dissent, because this will require no less than our taking back of our foreign policy and demanding that it reflects our values. It will require us to reevaluate the cost to our society and our psyche of being a great warrior nation and global bully. It will require us to realize that freedom and self-determination mean that we have the patience to refrain from manipulating other countries to our ends with our money and intrigues so that they can govern themselves and participate as working peers, friends in our global community. It will require us to insist on restraint when it comes to defining our national interest, and it will require us to insist on ethical behavior from our leaders. It will require us as a community to take control of our military, and even more difficult, our CIA and World Bank. It will require us to speak our minds at the dinner table, the water cooler, and here in the pulpit. It will require us to march in the streets and vote at the ballot box. It will require us to try and understand why a people not so different from ourselves would die to try to attack us. It will require us to, as we did in the middle part of the last century, in the face of economic crises and world war, to eschew fear and to make examples of ourselves in the world, translating our character as a people into true world leadership. It will require us to reach out to other nations with trust, trade, and peace, and not manipulation and fear. It will require us to become true patriots that build an inspiring nation that all can be proud of. It will require us, as it did for Gandhi and King, to go to jail in civil disobedience. And it will require us to find brave leaders who will risk all, even life itself, to realize change. It will require us to do everything short of violence. It will require us to see our enemies, not as such, but rather as human beings. It will require us to live the peace we sing about. Amen.